Hi there, this is Rabbi Rachel Hirsch. I'm coming to you from Jessa's Falls Grove office in Rockville, Maryland. Welcome to this episode of our Resiliency Radio podcast, where we join with staff and other participants to share about all the different ways that our organization supports resilience in the community for people of all backgrounds, all ages, all stages. Today, we are joined by Dr. Matthew Beal, Chair of the Division of Child, Adolescent, and Family Psychiatry at Georgetown Medical Center. Matt is also involved in the community and has been a presenter at some of our JESSA programs. Today, Matt will be joining us to talk about teen mental health. So let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about you, what drew you into the field of psychiatry and maybe especially child and adolescent psychiatry.
Sure. So glad to be with you. Thank you for the invitation. And yeah. I'm always delighted to have a chance to talk with you. So I've been in the field for over 20 years. I grew up knowing that I loved working with kids. I was drawn to teaching. I was drawn to healthcare too. I thought maybe I'd be a pediatrician. I went to medical school, and in medical school, I sort of loved everything, but with some very good mentorship, I started to notice the things that I loved most. And what I loved most were people's stories. What I loved most was the chance to spend a little more time with patients. And whether I was learning about surgery or obstetrics or pediatrics or what have you, what I was most interested in is going back at the end of the day and talking to patients more about how they got there and about their lives. And as an undergraduate student, I had studied history and anthropology and psychology, and I was really sort of interested in all the facets of people and
understanding our humanity in a more holistic
from every way. Possible vantage point, and including biologically and psychologically, but also ethnographically and historically and spiritually and every way. And so I decided to go into psychiatry because I felt like this was something that would never be boring. If I did it 10,000 times, it wouldn't be boring. I always was really drawn to working with kids and working with families. And so that was a natural fit that I was most interested in the origins of our emotional and behavioral and social patterns and how they emerge in families and how they emerge in cultures and how they change over the lifespan. And so, and just the experience of sitting with a child and finding a way to make a connection is something that is always delightful for me.
Yeah.
Even for kids who aren't feeling delightful on a particular day, I still really enjoy it.
Yeah. It's just,
that was sort of how I got there.
An endlessly fascinating puzzle, I think.
I think so.
Patient in front of you and just acknowledging, you know, what you discovered as a young medical student, it sounds like the challenge that pediatricians, surgeons, you know, people of all medical subspecialties deal with, which is that the time they have to get to know a patient is limited, and the possibility of addressing that patient's needs and challenges are so enhanced when you get to know them more holistically and get to hear more about what's operating in their world.
That's exactly right. And I think the other probably thread for me was in medicine and in healthcare and in society, mental health gets short shrift. And so this probably comes from my cultural background in some ways of really rooting for the underdog and being drawn toward the places that aren't getting enough light or enough attention. Oftentimes people, you see this very clearly in medical school and in life around the hospital, is that people who have mental illnesses get the worst care. They get the worst medical care and surgical care, and not necessarily for any malign reason, but there's levels of complexity and challenge. And sometimes it's for malign reasons. Sometimes it's they're really neglected and mistreated, and sometimes they're just misunderstood.
Yeah.
But it was very clear to me that this was like a theme that ran across every field of medicine.
Do you think that's because mental health challenges can be so complex and harder to quote unquote fix? Whereas if we have a surgical procedure to fix that issue, we do the procedure and hopefully we send the patient home and yay, we're successful. Whereas mental health care is usually not as straightforward and harder to get at.
I think that's a very apt analysis. I remember other mentors in my medical school when I said I was going to decided that I was going to go into psychiatry, looking at me like, "What are you talking about? Like, that's not medicine. That's something else."
Huh.
And in some ways they're right. It very much is medicine, and it also very much is something else. Mm-hmm. It's both.
How would you describe the something else?
I think it's similar to what you were just referencing. There's a complexity to human psychology and behavior. So, I mean, certainly the conditions that we treat in psychiatry and mental health care are deeply rooted in biology, in genetics, in the interaction between genes and environment, just like every other condition in healthcare is. I mean, in schizophrenia and depression, just as much as in high blood pressure and macular degeneration.
Mm.
And mental illnesses, and also just every day-to-day mental health and mental well-being is so deeply interwoven with all of the other factors that make us human beings, mm-hmm. With our spirit and with our surroundings and with our economic well-being or lack thereof, and with our social connection or isolation, and with culture. There are connections between culture, for example, and our cardiovascular system,
correct.
For sure.
Correct.
The connections with our nervous system mm-hmm. are more explicit and deep, I think.
Mm. Wow. So you came through medical school and you realized that you were going to be focused on psychiatry, and just fill in the blanks. Like, how did you go from medical school to where you are now?
My senior year of medical school, I was in New York City. I was in medical school at Mount Sinai, mm-hmm. and I was doing September of my senior year of medical school, September 2001, I was doing elective mm-hmm. at Bellevue Hospital, which is the biggest public hospital in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And I was on the bus, on the 34th Street crosstown bus, coming from the west side of the east side.
Mm-hmm.
And the bus was stopped at Fifth Avenue and was not in traffic, was not moving.
Hmm.
And I looked up from whatever I was reading and looked down Fifth Avenue, and one of the towers was on fire.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
And so that day changed many things for millions of people.
Yeah.
But it really sort of focused me on both the experience of trauma at a population level, at a cultural
mm-hmm.
level,
mm-hmm.
and also on the ways in which there are opportunities to connect my interest in mental health and psychiatry with my interest in public health. I was doing a public health community medicine degree simultaneous with my medical degree. So I was,
oh, wow.
Already focusing on public health and community medicine, community care.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up spending most of that year, most of my senior year of medical school, working with families who had lost someone in the attacks on the World Trade Center.
Wow.
And so I was really sort of focused on trauma, on direct experience of trauma, and on secondary or vicarious trauma, the trauma of hearing about someone else's trauma.
Yes.
So I worked a lot with first responders who had been involved that day, and also who had not been involved that day, and who'd lost comrades in the towers. So it was, my way of coping with the general grief of being a New Yorker then was to spend a lot of time clinically and on scholarship related to the attacks. And I got really interested in trauma and trauma's effect on families. And so I ended up staying in New York couldn't leave New York then.
Yeah.
So I stayed in New York for residency and fellowships out there for 5 more years at NYU and Bellevue, and working in public mental health care for kids and families, and was really drawn to the systems of care around mm-hmm. mental health care, or mm-hmm. that's just, and also the lack of systems of care for mental health care, particularly for poor people in our country. And so I was interested in these sort of intersections of health and mental health and public health and public well-being and how to understand the systems that we had and how to think about improving systems.
Matt, I'm going to pause you just for a second. This whole story is so extraordinary. So you're in New York. You're in this extraordinary training laboratory, which is the post 9/11 city and community. And as you're beginning to, you know, tease out here, you're sort of experiencing all the different ways that trauma is manifesting for people who have been in relationship to this catastrophe. And it starts to shape what you think you want to do with your psychiatry training.
Very much so. I left this part out, but I also had, I had a couple of personal losses that day as well. Mm. So it was a total overlap between people in my life who died that day, and then my neighbors and fellow travelers on the subway, and you know all the ways in which life in a city densely overlaps. And so I ended up coming back to the DC area, starting to work at Georgetown at the hospital. And my first job post training was working with children who had very serious medical illnesses. So children who had cancer, children who had organ transplants, children who had very serious traumatic experiences that were life-threatening. Mm. I was in the hospital every day working with kids who were really in life and death situations. Yeah. And realizing that a lot of what I was doing was working with their families and their parents. Mm-hmm. It's something that is, you know, sort of not advertised about when you work with kids, is that it's really family work.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I enjoyed that. It was incredibly enriching and difficult and rewarding work. And then I sort of started to have opportunities to look at the mental health landscape in DC, which was really underserving a lot of kids and families. It was really sort of an underdeveloped landscape in terms of mental health services that were happening for kids and families in DC. This is going back 2007, 2008, 2009.
Okay.
And really before there was the same kind of public conversation about mental health for children.
So you're saying, there's been a shift. Was there?
For sure. I think that was sort of just before the shift. I ended up having this opportunity to build a program at our hospital and at the university focusing on child and family mental health. And that included building a clinical program and building training programs for students and then building partnerships with a number of different organizations around the district with schools and with preschools and early education programs and pediatric providers and OBGYN providers. And there's all this sort of like this incipient interest of like that we need to be doing more around mental health, particularly around kids' mental health. It was an opportunity to build, and it was this public health perspective on how do we start to connect gaps in the system and fill those gaps so that kids at school are better supported psychologically and emotionally. And so pediatricians are better equipped to address common mental health concerns that emerge when kids come in for routine visits. And so that families have better information and guidance around what to expect from around their children's development and where to go for help when they were concerned and how to get help themselves around the stresses and strains of parenting. And so that was a sort of a trajectory of over the last almost 20 years. I like complexity and I like thinking about the way things work and where they break down and working across systems and working across cultures, not just ethnic and racial and social cultures, but also across professional cultures.
I was going to say interdisciplinary.
Absolutely.
Integration. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I often found it really exciting and challenging to be the mental health professional in a room with educators or with parents or with pediatricians or with law enforcement or policymakers and figuring out how to effectively translate some of the emerging science we have around the mental health and development of children, adolescents and their families and the implications or the applications to these different sectors. So that's been a really fun place to work. These opportunities were coming along right as the world was sort of waking to the fact of like, you know, children have minds that are different than adult minds and respond to their environments differently than adults do.
And benefit, I was going to say, they benefit from the application of specialized attention.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say your work has evolved exactly during this window where we've been watching teen mental health concerns rise to alarming levels. And I wanted to kind of turn the conversation in that direction, if that's okay. So you were saying you came back to D.C. in the late 2007. And so you were here, and then...
That was the year the iPhone came out.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to start right there? And about the some of the thinking that's unfolded more recently about the impact of technology, our relationship with technology on teen mental health?
I'll do my best. I'll try to do a synthesis here of the thesis of people like Jonathan Haidt and others. He's the most prominent voice, is that around 2008, 2010, 2012, in that era, that childhood changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that particularly because of the introduction of intense exposure to digital media in all of our lives, mm-hmm. every day, all day right. long.
It's in our hands all day long. Mm-hmm.
Including the lives of children in their hands all day long, every day.
Yeah.
That childhood change, that children were exposed to material and to stimuli and to distraction and fascination mm-hmm. from digital media that has sort of overpowered kids' capacities to turn away.
Yeah.
And that parents haven't had the knowledge, skills, tools, or support to properly scaffold away from or around those that sort of immense distraction and invasion in kids' lives. And that childhood has also changed around the way that children spend their time, the way mm-hmm. the overstructuring of children's lives, the lack of free time to play, the lack of time in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Children's lives are immensely regulated and controlled by adults, and that those things are mutually reinforcing. And I think go back probably to before. I think most people think like this is not just a digital media phenomenon. This goes back to starting in the late 80s, early 90s with mm-hmm. Concerns about child safety. You know, back to the times we all remember when we started seeing the pictures of missing children on the back of milk cartons.
Right, right.
And this sense that like a child who, like something terrible happening to a child 3,000 miles away meant that our children were less safe.
Hmm.
And this sort of shared information age crossed with like increased attention to dangerous things happening, which are unfortunately very interesting to us.
Yes.
Made everybody more concerned, maybe overly concerned, maybe like totally preoccupied with children's safety, and then sort of made children's freedom sort of really curtailed. Like there's that whole narrative as well.
Yeah. And not to get too lost in this, but just, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm just thinking of what was happening in the 1980s, I guess the first wave of the changes that fell into families during the momentum behind the women's liberation movement. I guess what I'm trying to get to is, do you make any connection between that rising sense of concern, global, you know, general concern about kids' safety with the fact that more and more households had two parents working or, you know, kind of no adult at home or a different latchkey kids? I don't know.
We get drawn into many historical explanations mm-hmm. that are probably a few shades too neat about when things started.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that the digital media connects back to reduction in children's freedom, which connects back to latchkey kids and two parents working outside the home,
mm-hmm.
which connects back to sort of social trends that were happening before. This sort of perennial sense that childhood was simpler, better, and safer then, which is both true and also sort of like overly simplified.
Right. A romanticization of.
One of the ways in which like I think it's important to sort of walk this dialectic between like our mental health is both really affected by the environment and also really biological.
Mm-hmm.
Children having anxiety or adolescents addictive substances too much
mm-hmm.
or young adults failing to launch and falling into sort of patterns of depression and dysfunctional behaviors. And like those are not new. Those go mm-hmm. back for human centuries history. And right. and millennia, mm-hmm. Because they're in our genes. Like those, there are biological substrates that go some distance toward explaining all of these things that are part of being human, that are part of being a child and an adolescent and a young adult.
Mm-hmm.
And these environmental factors sort of draw them out differently in different ages.
Yeah.
When you start to sort of think that maybe the environment is an outsized factor in what's going on, mm-hmm. is where you see things in data that really seems to represent an outsized change. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, in 2005, most national health data suggested that 5 or 10% of kids were struggling with persistent sadness or depressive symptoms early and late adolescence. And then in 2020, 2022, mm-hmm. that's 50%. So in 20 years, like the human species doesn't change that fast.
Yeah.
Going from 10% of a prevalence of a health condition to 50% in 20 years. Like something else is going on there. And it's complicated, right? Like part of what's going on there is digital media and the change of childhood. And part of what's going on there is an idiom of distress. Distress is a human experience.
Yeah.
Right? Overwhelm, a sense of like, I don't know that I can handle what's required of me.
Yes.
And the experience of that is as I am depressed, mm-hmm. and I'm experiencing depression, and I'm experiencing loneliness, and I'm experiencing isolation, and I'm experiencing hopelessness, mm-hmm. which are these symptoms of depression. Those are also symptoms of our age right now.
Yes.
Of this era in our culture. And it's a language that people use to express something that I think is more timeless or perennial.
Just call it idiom of...
of distress.
Of distress. Is there anything to the question of... I thought you were going to say young people nowadays have much more vocabulary for what they are feeling. There's much more content in the world they live in that points towards questions about mental health. It seems to me, my perception is that it has actually become less stigmatized. You know, my kids are very comfortable talking about their therapist or their whatever. Whereas when I was a teenager, it was sort of still like, don't really talk about that. You know, you can talk about going to the dentist, but don't say that you went to your therapist. Right. Now it's almost like you're not cool if you don't have a therapist. What's wrong with you? So I'm just wondering if you think there's any relationship between the spike. I mean, to go from, what did you say, 5 yes. to 10% in 2005 to now close to 50%.
Correct.
20 years later. Is any of that attributable to just a change in how we talk about these things? And the actual yes. instance of it isn't necessarily going through.
What you're saying is exactly what I meant. It's language that yes. is standing in for something that is larger, and that is like it's a young people now are using the language of mental health
mm-hmm.
and of emotional distress as a way to express all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
To express genuine psychiatric illness, which I think is more common than it was before in young people. Okay. And also to express more normative developmental strain. It's not easy to be the age that your kids are or my kids are.
Yeah.
It's always been hard to be an adolescent and to be in your 20s and to be finding your path and mm-hmm. to be solidifying your identity and to be managing all kinds of existential dread and uncertainty. It's really hard.
Yeah. And so let's add in some yeah. of those elements of existential dread or uncertainty. One other colleague that I spoke to as part of this series a few months ago pointed to the spike, the proliferation of gun violence in schools as a major factor in teen mental health. And he, you know, kind of put that into recent historical context and showed the relationship between, you know, Columbine and then the other horrific events that have happened and that rise. And then the other question that everybody asks. So it's social media, gun violence, and then the pandemic.
Well, I've got a couple more.
Okay.
Climate.
Mm-hmm.
And political polarization and the way that we mm-hmm. talk to each other and about each other in this country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's like a petri dish for mental health issues to fester.
I think it's a petri dish for mental health issues to fester. It's an accelerant for distress and for the increasing need to use these idioms mm-hmm. to express a sense of like, what the heck's going on here?
Yeah.
And are we going to be okay? Am I going to be okay? And are we going to be okay?
Mm-hmm.
I know you're hoping to talk too about places for hope and
yes.
for resilience.
Yeah.
My family is sick of me talking about this. You know, that's what's happened periodically, although there'll be another topic soon. But I, you know, using climate as an example, there are so many reasons to be concerned. There are so many reasons to be in a crisis mode,
mm-hmm.
to accelerate our crisis response, to continue to take this more seriously than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we talk about it with young people, I think is really troubling. And troubling for young people and deserves correction.
Yeah, say more about that. The way we adults talk about these issues with young people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's probably a parallel we could talk about with the pandemic,
mm.
where there's such a urgency that many adults feel
mm-hmm.
to convince those around us, particularly those with whom we feel like we may not have many points of agreement,
mm.
to take this thing seriously, to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
We get hyperbolic. We downplay or ignore mixed evidence or complexity
mm-hmm.
or nuance or just uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
We forget to be humble about what we know and we don't.
Mm-hmm.
We have so much certainty about our predictions, about what is going to happen, what must happen.
Yeah.
And as a result, we get like this, we're so strident in what, mm-hmm. the way we talk about
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just scares the hell out of kids.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about it a lot. I really think we need to be more vigilant about what we don't know
mm-hmm.
and what might change mm-hmm. and what is changeable
mm-hmm.
and all the ways in which the story's not written yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we're still writing it and we've all got a role in writing it. And I think that doesn't get enough attention. There's too much attention to doomsday language and
yeah.
attitudes and children really absorb that.
That doomsday, you know, I've gone from 0 to 60. I'm already apocalyptic or whatever language you want to use. It's not a hopeful stance, at least what I'm hearing. It's so powered by social media. And what I mean by that is social media trolls for what will get people's attention, as we know. And so it's, you know, it's just not that thrilling to go, huh, that's so interesting. Let's think about that together. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'd be curious to learn more. That's a much less news flashy orientation to have. And so it doesn't sort of make it into the social media ether the way, you know, breaking news.
If you look at the sort of core ingredients of resilience,
mm-hmm.
a core ingredient of resilience is hopefulness.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that what is not necessarily what will be. And if you lose that, or if that is discouraged or ignored or stepped on
mm-hmm.
again and again and again, it really does curtail the capacity for resilience, the capacity to weather difficult things. It's mm-hmm. really hard to weather difficult things when you don't have the sense that things can change and that I can play some small part in that change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that I can manage difficult things and get through them. I've done it before. I can do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Like those internal narratives are really important. And when the message is all around. And I think you're right about digital media, but and maybe we've all been trained by digital media at this point, to,
mm-hmm.
because I also think it's present in the way that we just talk to one another in everyday conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything is to the end. If you express skepticism or even sort of humility about what's knowable, what's predictable,
yeah,
that scene somehow is sort of colluding with the forces of darkness.
Or at the very least, it doesn't sell. It doesn't sell. So it doesn't get yeah. attention.
Right.
Yeah. I love the way you just helped us shift into how do we talk about hope and resilience? What are things that we as adults in the lives of our teens, as parents, as educators, clergy, extracurricular activity leaders of different kinds, what can we do to help shift the landscape for teens? I was thinking you were going to say, well, obviously, the first thing is that we all have to work on ourselves. We adults.
Yes. I mean, I sort of have a talking points on resilience that I will share with folks. And all of them are fundamentally relational,
mm-hmm.
meaning that you can't teach them to someone else without cultivating them in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, and they don't really make sense as concepts other than in the context of relationships. These are some ingredients that help people to be resilient. One, the first is emotional regulation, which is basically sort of the capacity to feel intense emotions and not be totally overwhelmed or snowed by them. So, the ability to sort of feel intensely sad, fearful, angry, excited, and then to sort of come back to some kind of an equilibrium. And the way that we mostly do that as human beings is with one another, is to share. I'm feeling this thing. Are you feeling it too? Help me understand what I'm feeling. Let me help you understand what you're feeling. That emotional regulation is really co-regulation, is regulating together. And so the best regulated people are people who have a lot of practice regulating their own emotions. So for adults who are parents or teachers or clergy or counselors or have any kind of interaction with children, the more that you have are fluent in your own sort of emotional vocabulary and emotional regulation, the more you can be able to help kids to co-regulate. So that's a really important ingredient. The second ingredient we've already talked about, which is hopefulness. The sense that hopefulness and optimism are not the same, right? Optimism is, it'll be better later. I'm going to take a nap until it's better. And hopefulness is like, it can get better and I've got to be a part of making it better. And so hopefulness is really critical. Basic problem-solving skills of, this is, I'm confronted with this problem or this challenge or this dilemma, and I need some practical skills to help me get through it. I need some strategies. So adults can certainly help kids with that. We can help one another with that.
I'm thinking about as sorry, I'm interrupting you here, but I'm just thinking about that, just that last point that you were on about how do you cultivate hope? And is it part of it by practice, like you practice anything else? You practice your piano skills, you practice your soccer kicks, you practice, your reading phonetics, whatever it is. You also can practice by having, experiences of skill building around hopefulness.
Totally. You can practice and you can also notice. There are things that I overhear or read that, without even intending to, activate my hopefulness. I'm getting to the age now where that happens by reading obituaries. Right? It's like this sign of middle age is loving obituaries and reading about people's lives that were so rich and amazing.
Inspiring.
It's hope-giving. Of like, look what a person can do with a life. And there are obviously many more mundane experiences than that too. But noticing what makes you hopeful, practicing hopefulness, pulling it out of the people around us, like all of those things, I think that's exactly right.
I'm hearing that there's a strong thread here for the role that spiritual life can play in that, because that really, that's what spiritual life is practicing. Practicing hopefulness, practicing faith.
Any list of resilience factors would be incomplete without including sort of a sense of meaning. The suffering or the challenge is acceptable or worthwhile or tolerable because there's something larger at play here. Remembering to feel small in the face of really large things can help to make our difficulties feel manageable and navigable, which is, and obviously spirituality is immensely helpful there too.
It sounds like you're not feeling dread, or you're feeling somewhat hopeful about our capacity as human beings to address at least the conversation here about the teen mental health issues that are before us. We can kind of right the ship, so to speak. Would you say
I think
so?
we can. Getting back to the concrete, there are some, there's some newer data the last couple of years that we may be heading back in a better direction on a population health level, that sort of levels of distress and levels of depression and anxiety and loneliness among young people may be improving. That suggests that we're not in some sort of a stuck place, and that the reduction in stigma that you alluded to, and the fact that we're taking these issues much more seriously than ever before, and trying to be helpful and responsive to young people, I think is a reason for hope. I think that the more that we reformulate the youth mental health crisis as a family mental health crisis, the better. Because I think it helps us keep in mind all of the interpersonal and relational factors that go into mental health. And when families are supported, strong, stable, and healthy, kids are better off. Doesn't totally inoculate kids against mental health concerns, but it would help. And I think it's a reformulation that I've really been trying to figure out how to advance, because I think it's really important. I think that parents are really having a hard time. I guess it's really hard to be a parent right now, too. To a kid of any age, but particularly parents of adolescents right now, are really trying to navigate the way the world is. All of the things that we are trying to get our heads around in terms of social trends and concerns, whether it's polarization or climate or violence or entrenched poverty, like all of those things are part of the youth mental health crisis, and getting better at addressing and solving those problems, and also just getting better at talking about them in a way that's more balanced and less cataclysmic will be good for all of us.
Yeah. That's a great place to land for now, Matt. Thank you so much. I hope it goes without saying, just what a treat to get to just talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for tuning in to Jessa's Resiliency Radio podcast. I'm your host, Rabbi Rachel Hirsch. Today, our guest was Dr. Matt Beal. Our podcast editor and producer is Gabe Pinkney. For more information about our Resiliency Radio podcast, or to learn about Jessa's programs and services, log on to jessa.org. That's jssa.org. Thank you, and have a great day.